From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a call to action for the Texas coast, which Hurricane Harvey has shown us needs a plan to deal with superstorms and global warming.
There's never been a storm like Harvey. No city in the United States could have handled Harvey, but we all may be looking at Harveys in the future. And these are the things we're going to have to anticipate, and we're occupying some very dangerous real estate here on the Texas coast, and we're going to have to get a lot smarter about it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Governor Greg Abbott estimates that the damage from Hurricane Harvey will total between $150 and $180 billion. Harvey will be more costly than the epic hurricanes Katrina or Sandy. As global temperatures continue to rise, climate scientists have said this is what we should expect, more huge storms with drastic impacts. Though scientists are still wrestling with some of the specifics on how global climate change is impacting hurricanes, it is known that hurricane seasons like this one could be the new norm. Texas needs to decide what to do about that. Should we rebuild the homes and businesses lost in Harvey in the same manner in the same places? Or should we realize there will be other Harveys and hurricanes that will be even worse and take appropriate action? A new book, A Texan Plan for the Texas Coast, argues that Texas needs to adopt aggressive policies that factors the population growth on the coast and the vulnerabilities of communities, infrastructure, and natural areas. Jim Blackburn is the author. He's a professor of environmental law at the Department of Environmental Engineering at Rice University. He's also the co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center at Rice University.
We saw an unprecedented event. We saw an event that if we had modeled it, people would have told us that we were crazy, that we were fear-mongers. And so what we really saw was evidence of the change that we're seeing in our storms. Our storms are becoming more severe and seriously more severe. And that is a huge problem and is hard sometimes to get people to realize what we have in store for us. And we have to think ahead and plan for these things.
What did Harvey mean for the wetlands of Texas?
Well, I think for Harvey and wetlands, I think what Harvey did is something that I talk about in the book, A Texan Plan for the Texas Coast, is there's value in natural wetlands. The wetlands to the west of town can hold tremendous amounts of water that would be a protection for Houston. The wetlands of the Texas coast are essentially a buffer that can hold tremendous amounts of, that can store tremendous amounts of surge over land that can recover from it. So I think the issue is that these lands have tremendous value, and we have never really understood that. We always think of wetlands from an anti-regulatory standpoint and not in terms of the dollar value they represent. And the coastal wetlands are incredibly valuable to the fisheries and to the wildlife of the coast. The inland wetlands are incredibly important in terms of water balances, both flood and water supply.
So if we had not contracted the wetlands that we have on the Texas coast as we have, would we have seen less storm damage from Harvey?
Well, in the case of Houston and Hurricane Harvey or Tropical Storm Harvey when it hit us, yes, I think we would have seen a reduction in the amount of runoff that came. We have covered many of the wetlands that were in the White Oak Bayou watershed, which is northwest Houston, the Attucks and Barker watershed, which are in sort of west Houston, and Braes Bayou in southwest Houston. And those areas used to hold tremendous amounts of water. And we've always had flooding. We'll always have flooding. But our flooding is made more severe by our development patterns and by our channelizing and covering our wetlands with concrete. These were our natural sponges, and we have lost a lot of them, and we've got to save what we've got left. And that's where the value of nature comes in.
Did Harvey do any damage to sandbars and other things that usually protect the Texas coast?
The history of the Texas coast and hurricanes is that the hurricanes, I think, have generally been beneficial for the estuaries. They flush out the system. You basically may see new passes opened. You'll see sandbars shift. You may see oyster reefs getting covered with sediment. But all of that basically evens out over a period of 6 months to a couple of years. Now, there will be some short-term losses. But I think in the long term, these storms are very beneficial in terms of the formation of the coast and the functioning of the coast, because the coast evolved with these storms. In the book, I talk about a whole chapter about hurricanes, and we have a history of hurricanes on the Texas coast. There's a history going back thousands of years of hurricanes in the Texas coast. And that's how our shoreline was formed. Our plants have evolved in that. Our estuaries have evolved in light of those severe storm events. It's our human development that has not evolved. And that's the problem, is we insist on sticking sort of hard-edged human development into a very soft-edged natural system that is the Texas coast.
You write about empty world thinking versus full world thinking. Can you talk about what that means?
Sure. In the book, A Texan Plan for the Texas Coast, I talk initially and really almost totally throughout the book, I keep coming back to empty world versus full world thinking. And this terminology goes back to an economist named Herman Daly. And he's really talking about the fact that the world that, for example, my parents grew up in, and certainly their parents, you know, back in the 1800s, in the early 1900s, we really were looking at a frontier where we were moving into an area that was relatively free of humans and human impacts, and we could basically do damage and it really wouldn't make much of a difference. But the world is filling up with people, and all of a sudden, Texas is full. We're using up our water supplies. We're starting to run into problems with carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we're seeing these issues about climate change that are emerging. And those are issues that come from a world full of people. And our economic system, our system of ethics, our system of kind of how we relate to each other is really based in that world that is an empty world rather than the reality we're facing today, which is of a world that's full of people and human impacts. And we've got to basically make changes in the way we think about any number of subjects based upon this dichotomy between empty world and full world.
How does that impact the way that we need to be thinking about the Texas coast?
Well, I think with the Texas coast, for example, we've always assumed that water was just there to be taken, and then surface water went to the first users that would apply it to some sort of what we consider beneficial economic activity like agriculture or industry or to municipalities. In the process, we've taken all the water away from the bays. And so our bays are becoming starved. We dried up the Rio Grande River. The mouth silted over in 2000. Nueces Bay was declared ecologically dead by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality in 2011. We killed 24 hooping cranes in 2011 because we didn't let enough water get to the bay to give the health to the bay that was necessary. Bays depend on freshwater inflow in order to raise crabs and shrimp, and hooping cranes depend on crabs. Fish depend on shrimp. The fishing was bad in 2011. The hooping cranes died. The economy of the Rockport area crashed during that time because enough water didn't get to the coast. That is an empty world, full world dilemma there, because basically we've got an empty world water system for Texas, but we've got full world realities, and that system has to change.
So, Jim Blackburn, you're a lawyer. So what's a solution through the law?
The solution through the law is to use the law every time we can. I mean, one of the points of the book is it is a Texan plan for the coast, and I really don't see regulation being brought to bear under the current Texas concept of governance. I've tried for years to bring regulation to the coast, and I have run my head into a number of walls. So the role of law is to use every device we've got right now to get as much as we can. There's a whole chapter in the book about the hooping crane lawsuit that was brought that I brought against the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality for killing 24 hooping cranes back in 2011. And that lawsuit ultimately was unsuccessful, yet the act of taking on the state in a federal court setting, and we won big in district court and then lost at the Court of Appeals, I think that was a fundamental shakeup in the way that the state kind of saw itself relative to being vulnerable to legal attacks. And we ended up with an excellent negotiated agreement coming out of that dispute that may change the way we think about water rights in Texas. So I think the role of law is you can use the law to basically fight for what's important. And it's important that these fights take place. I mean, in Texas, you know, you really have to fight for something that you care about or else you are very likely to lose it. And I think the lesson is the law is one of the tools, particularly the court system, is a tool that can be used and can be used effectively. It should be used relatively sparingly, but it is a real tool to be used to protect the coast. And I think with good thinking, with a plan, with a strategic plan of how to use litigation, it has a key role.
What about the Day case and what that means for water and how that connects to the Texas coast?
Well, the Day case was Edwards Aquifer Authority, or Day versus Edwards Aquifer Authority, and the Day plaintiff basically had been denied a permit by the Edwards Aquifer Authority and was challenging the denial of that permit under several grounds, and it got to the Texas Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court decided three important things in the Day case. One, groundwater districts in Texas could legally regulate. Two, groundwater was private property in Texas, and it was an element of the landowner's right as a surface owner. So if you own the surface, you own the groundwater, even if you haven't got a well into it. And then third, a groundwater district can be sued for taking private property if they deny a permit to take water. And all that depends on circumstances, but they created the right of a takings lawsuit. What it means in terms of the coast is that we used to get a lot of our freshwater inflow to the coast from spring flows and from seeps. And basically, the groundwater now becomes an asset of the landowner. And the case also upheld what's called the rule of capture, which allows the landowner to take as much water as they wish without regard to the impact to the neighbors. So the law really, being the case, really set up conflicting theories that need to be sorted out better by the courts. But in one interpretation of these theories, we will lose important spring flows to the coast from the taking of groundwater and really from the sale of groundwater to our large municipalities. I think the other thing the Day case means is that we need to be very vigilant about protecting our groundwater because, frankly, the water that gets stolen from under your property is your private property, so you have a right to fight for it. So it's a very interesting dilemma that landowners are faced with where they get sort of benefits and negatives. The coast gets primarily negatives, but we need to balance all of that out. And the Day case is just what we have to work with, and, frankly, creative lawyering can go a long way on that.
So empty world thinking versus full world thinking is a rule of capture, empty world thinking, and we need to update that?
Yeah, absolutely. The rule of capture is empty world thinking. It's a perfect example of what I'm talking about, the legal system being backwards. The rule of capture comes out of a 1904 Supreme Court of Texas case, and they were worried about groundwater analysis and groundwater evaluation depending on essentially the use of water witch technology, if you will. They're talking about basically involving the dark arts in the assessment of groundwater. And you know, we're way past that these days. I mean, we have very sophisticated groundwater analytical tools, and we're no longer talking about the use of magic or dark arts in evaluating groundwater, yet that's what our Texas Supreme Court precedent is based upon, is that type of thinking. And, you know, it's just totally in the empty world.
What are some of the specific problems that the Texas coast is facing?
The Texas coast faces, I think, three big problems. One is freshwater inflows for our bays and estuaries, and we're going to have to price water better because there's harm being done to the coast. We're losing shrimp production. We're losing oyster production. We're losing recreational fishing. Anytime our bays get impacted by denial of freshwater inflow, yet we charge nothing to take water out of the rivers, and we charge nothing to the water user for the harm they're causing downstream. That has to change. Second thing is we've got to maintain our large ranches. Our large ranches are, I think, a key to the health of the Texas coast. And we've got, I'm very concerned about generating additional cash flow for landowners, particularly large ranch holders, who are under constant pressure, oftentimes from heirs that are coming into the picture. And they would like to receive some income off of this land that they have inherited, or they might be tempted to sell it. We've got to increase that cash flow, and the buying and selling of what we call ecological services is one of the wonderful opportunities we have to do that. And we're working at Rice University to create a market for buying and selling of carbon dioxide. We can sell essentially the right to store carbon in farmers' lands and ranchers' lands to all companies that are going to need at a point in the future to essentially remove the carbon from the atmosphere that they are, that their products are emitting. And so we have, I think, a win-win situation where the oil and gas industry can begin to address the criticism that they're contributing to climate change, and we can help the landowners increase their cash flow. And I think the third thing about the Texas coast is that it's not as well known as it should be. 90% of the Texas coast is private property. Huge ownership in private property on the coast. People that move here from other places oftentimes don't know much about the Texas coast, and we need to learn much more about the Texas coast. And I think as a population, we need to become familiar with our coast, and we need to use our coast, because if we use something, we will care about it, and ultimately, we will protect those things that we care about. So the books about information, the books about buying and selling things like ecological services, and the book is about creating appreciation for the Texas coast, for the importance of the water, and using economic concepts to protect it, as well as personal will, spirituality, and frankly, a little competitive spirit.
This is Texas Matters. We're talking with environmental attorney Jim Blackburn, author of the new book, A Texan Plan for the Texas Coast. So we had Hurricane Harvey, Category 4, delivered a direct hit to Rockport. It was devastating there, and we saw a record amount of rainfall for the continental United States in Houston, devastating, but you say it could have been worse.
Oh, absolutely it could have been. The storm that hit Houston was a rainstorm. The worst-case storm hitting Houston would be a Category 4 storm, like an Irma that almost destroyed the Florida Keys and was aimed toward Florida and then basically came ashore without causing as much damage as they thought. We are extremely vulnerable in the Houston region particularly to a Category 4 event that hits on the south end of Galveston Island down around San Luis Pass and generates a 25-foot surge coming up the Houston Ship Channel. The Houston Ship Channel is home to the largest industrial complex in the United States and probably in the world. It is a center of refining and plastics manufacture. There's about 4,400 storage tanks on the channel, of which 2,200 would be flooded by a 25-foot surge. And in our modeling we've done at Rice, we estimate that that could generate about 90 million gallons of oil and hazardous substances to be released into neighborhoods and then into Galveston Bay. It would be the worst environmental disaster in United States history, given the enclosed nature of Galveston Bay and the fact that not only oil but hazardous substances would be released. Additionally, about 200,000 homes would be inundated by the surge. And this is a much more dangerous flood event than riverine flooding because of the power that a surge has with the waves breaking when the surge comes ashore. And you have houses literally destroyed and then used as battering rams against the next row of houses and the next row of houses. We could easily see a couple of thousand people killed in that storm as well.
Is this just a fictional idea, or is this a real threat?
The question about a hurricane, say, generating a 25-foot surge is a very interesting one as to whether it's a real threat or whether it is a fiction. And many of the people who have seen our modeling have criticized it as being unrealistic, saying we've never seen a storm like that, that a storm like that is unrealistic, that we're fear-mongering. That what's one of the good things about Harvey, and that basically Harvey did something. It dropped 40 to 50 inches of rain in a four-day period. That, again, had we predicted that, people would have said that we were absolutely unhinged. And so I think what we're seeing is greater, larger, and more severe storm events as a routine matter. There have been 25-foot surge events. There have been storms that hit the Texas coast that, had they hit at San Luis Pass, would have generated a 25-foot surge up into the Houston Ship Channel. I think the fact that it has never occurred in the Houston Ship Channel is one of the hardest things we're fighting against in terms of convincing both politicians and the public that this is something that serious money needs to be spent on to avoid. And then, of course, with Harvey coming along, we've got now competing demands for money. But there are definitely structures that can and should be built in our bay system or along the coast that can protect and prevent that type of harm from occurring. And it is something that we absolutely need to do, and we need to do it sooner than later.
So talk about these structures.
There are really two sort of competing structures that have been talked about, one of which was developed by Bill Merrill down at Texas A&M Galveston, and it's called the Ike Dike. And it's basically a 17-foot dike along the coast that kind of connects with the Galveston seawall, goes across where the ferry goes between Bolivar Peninsula and Galveston Island, and then has essentially elongated levees going all the way up to High Island to the north and all the way down to the end of Galveston Island on the south. About an 80-mile barrier. The gate structure would be in about 60 feet of water. The other 2 miles of the crossing would have to be basically a perforated concrete barrier, would be an extremely expensive gate and kind of relief system that would allow the water to move back and forth into the bay. The cost of this is estimated to be $10 to $15 billion. There is an alternative that involves basically the disposal areas along the Houston Ship Channel and basically putting a barrier along the ship channel that connects with the levee around Texas City to the south and connects up into the highlands of Chambers County on the north. And that protects the ship channel, all of the western shoreline of Galveston Bay. And to go with it, essentially a backside levee needs to be placed around the city of Galveston. That's about a $3 billion solution. Both of them are expensive. I think $3 billion could be provided by local bonds. The $10 to $15 billion, the federal government is probably the only realistic source. And we find ourselves in a very kind of odd position of, on the one hand, we decry the federal government, and on the other hand, we've got our hand out to the federal government, not only for these structures, but also now for Harvey relief. And frankly, we need probably $2 to $3 billion on the Texas coast for Harvey relief, maybe more, as well as some of these others. So we've got competing demands for serious money, and we're going to have to come up with it. And the feared word, taxes, may have to be discussed. Yeah, you know, if I were the federal government, I'm not sure I would give us any money locally if we were unwilling to spend our own money to also go into that pot to create the protections and to the buyouts and the structures that we need.
A lot of rebuilding on the Texas coast after Hurricane Harvey. What do they need to be thinking about, according to your research and your
ideas?
Well,
I think one of the problems is what we call the 100-year rainfall. I mean, all of our roads, all of our buildings, slabs, all of our flood insurance, the kind of thinking is all based on something called the 100-year floodplain. And we have seen a 100-year flood and even 500-year floods, and these are storms that are supposed to be very rare, you know, literally having a 1% or even a 0.5% chance of occurring or 0.2% chance of occurring in any year. And when you're looking at what we've seen in the recent past in Houston, we're getting these storms every other year. We're getting huge storms every other year. We're getting 100-year storms almost every year. I'm afraid our building standards are obsolete, And frankly, everything we're building new may be being built to obsolete standards. We've got to get a handle on that and get a handle on it quickly. This is part of this empty world, full world dilemma. I mean, the world that we're dealing with has storms that we have not previously seen. There's never been a storm like Harvey. No city in the United States could have handled Harvey, but we all may be looking at Harveys in the future. This surge I'm talking about has not occurred yet, but it could, and it's very real, reasonable to think that it might. And these are the things we're going to have to anticipate, and it's really a challenge to our fundamental belief structure almost of kind of who we are and what we are. And we're occupying some very dangerous real estate here on the Texas coast, and we're going to have to get a lot smarter about it. And hopefully the book will offer information, insights, and ideas about how to better live with both the hazards and the opportunities of the Texas coast.
How does global warming enter into this?
Well, I think global warming, which is a chapter in the book, is also addressed in the book in some of the solutions that are offered. Global warming is one of those really difficult subjects in Texas. I think in Texas we have code for global warming called weird weather, and I think people in Austin that work for the government are afraid to talk about climate change because they're afraid they're going to lose their job. Climate change is happening. I mean, you know, the statistics, I mean, are there. You know, our temperatures are getting hotter. The ocean is getting hotter. Sea level is rising. We're seeing more severe rainfall events. All of these things are happening. And common sense of most people agrees with that. I think everybody in Texas is freaked out about the implications of admitting to global climate change, or that the oil and gas industry particularly is related to climate change. And I think rather than shying away from that discussion, we ought to embrace that discussion and find solutions that will help the oil and gas industry, frankly, emerge from this challenge a stronger and better industry. One of the solutions in the book is to work with the ranching community and do carbon sequestration. And so basically the ranchers become, you know, carbon ranchers, and the oil companies can pay to basically store the carbon they're releasing back in the soil. And so you can begin to come up with ideas that help the agricultural economy and that allow the oil and gas industry to begin to address their principal critics. And those critics are not going away. This is a problem that's not going away. But this is also a perfect example of empty world and full world kind of problems and issues. Climate change was not an empty world problem. Our climate was not changing at the scale that it is changing now in the empty world. This is an artifact of humans and human use of petroleum product and combusting hydrocarbons and the carbon dioxide buildup in the atmosphere, all of which is man-made. And I can say the sooner we admit it and come to grips with it, the better we're all going to be. But many of us wish to stay in the empty world because the empty world was something we understood. It's like comfort food. And unfortunately, we're not necessarily living in a world that is filled with comfort food right now. We've got some hard realities we've got to address. And the sooner we do it, the sooner we will be able to have a Texas for the future that, frankly, we all can be proud of, and, frankly, a coast that we can protect and keep intact and basically have a living resource that's absolutely a jewel.
Jim Blackburn is the author of the new book, A Texan Plan for the Texas Coast, published by Texas A&M Press. Blackburn is a professor of environmental law in the Department of Environmental Engineering at Rice University. He's also the co-director of the Severe Storm Prediction, Education, and Evacuation from Disaster Center at Rice University. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.